Hi, I'm Aubra, and you're listening to the podcast for MinSpec, the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group. We meet monthly to learn more about the craft of writing. We also have a very active message board at www.meetup.com/MNSPEC. This episode is Legal Issues for Authors with Daniel E. Bone. Minnesota lawyer Daniel E. Bone runs his own legal practice specializing in entertainment law and intellectual property law. He is also a self-published author and a musician, so he understands both the artist side and the business side of copyright issues that all authors should be aware of. But first, let me tell you about what our members have been up to. Congratulations to Michael Merriam, whose novel, Old Blood's Fate, is now out from Artima Press. When Jack Clausen shows mercy to a dying coyote, a Native American spirit approves from the shadows. The Great Coyote is about to change Jack forever, for the time has come to awake the dreamer, while the Spirit Council watches, and some plan to betray him. Unbeknownst to Jack, he must rejoin with that part of himself that walks as the Nightmare, though the Nightmare is protected by an ancient witch who has her own plans for Jack, not to mention his friends and allies. Not even the Great Coyote can hope to control the outcome. You can purchase Old Blood's Fate at www.artemaepress.com/michael-merriam.html. That's michael-merriam.html. Coming up, Michael Merriam is also going to be a featured storyteller in the fiction track at the Story Arts Minnesota's first Story Fest, April 12, at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. He is also going to host the Ghost Stories track at the same festival. More info as it becomes available. As usual, Roy C. Booth has been very busy. He's been named a panelist for the 21st Century Publishing Industry, Media, and the Future of Print conference sponsored by the University of Minnesota Duluth to be held on April 12th. The panel is Marketing and Retailing Books in the 21st Century, Retailer and Librarian Perspective. His one-act comedy, with some minor fantasy underpinnings, The Glover's Mange Cure Caper, has been picked for two royalty-paid performances by Wilton Public School of Wilton, North Dakota. Also, his award-winning one-act comedy, Two Wives and a Dead Guy, was recently produced for royalty by the Hockomock Players of Swan's Island, ME. And if you want to listen to a radio broadcast of MinSpec authors Dana Baird, Joel Arnold, Conrad Zero, and myself, and host Terry Faust talking about the publishing industry, you can stream it at http://node/34502. And now, on to the discussion.
So welcome to the MinSpec Writers Group. I'm Conrad. Today we're talking about legal stuff for authors, intellectual property rights and such. And this is Dan Bowen. I know Dan through a mutual friend. It's a rare case of social media that actually worked. The way you hear the myth about social media that I've done, that I went on LinkedIn. I was looking for an intellectual property lawyer, and typed that in as a search. Came up with Dan, and lo and behold, we had a common friend. And I said to this common friend, "Hey, could you introduce us?" And it worked out just like it's supposed to. So that's how Dan is here. He's done some work for me, and very pleased. And we got to talking, and I said this stuff that I have 10,000 questions, and I'm sure everybody else here does too, about intellectual property law and copyright and stuff. So I asked him to come out and talk to us. So how many people here are self-published or plan to self-publish some work? how many people here are traditionally published or seeing traditional publishing. Okay. So both are going to need to know. You're either, if you're self-publishing, you're the publisher who's going to be making contracts for other people. If you are going through a traditional publisher, you're going to be receiving these contracts from a publisher. And Dan has been on both sides of this, being in the music industry for a long time. He was bass player in the band Polera, for anybody who remembers Polera. So he's seen a lot of legal entertainment stuff and put himself through law school so he could understand the contracts that he was signing, right?
Yeah.
So why don't you give some background and fill us in on your experience.
Sure. Well, thanks to all of you for having me. It's really real pleasure to be talking to you all. My name is Dan Bowen, and before I went to law school, I was a web and interactive media developer and also a musician. And then I decided to go to law school, and I did that. Graduated a couple of years ago, and I'm doing a solo practice now. And it was a lifetime of had a largely creative life before I extinguished it for 4 years in law school. And I'm trying to get my creative brain back now. But I mean, I'm still doing a lot of cool stuff. But my focus now is to help people work with their creative projects and get them somewhere and get satisfied with them and get their business done right. I also still do some creative writing. I write a comic strip called Space Skull, and a friend of mine illustrates it. And so it's quite an epic story. I've got about a 2 or 3 year plan for this whole thing. And I'd much rather talk to you about Space Skull for the next hour, but I did put it there just to show you my writing credentials, creative writing credentials. I was an English major in undergrad and everything. Studied a lot of modern age literature, 20th century World War I and II era literature, world literature, Russian literature, things like that. But let's move on. Let's get to the nitty gritty. This wouldn't be a good legal talk to non-legal people without a disclaimer. So I have to tell you that this presentation is not legal advice. It's just a general overview of everyday law in the publishing and entertainment world. So, don't rely on this presentation. Anybody listening to this podcast, don't rely on this, of course. If you have a specific issue, for best results, contact a lawyer. It's always a good idea.
A disclaimer too that we are podcasting and recording what everybody says, so if you don't swear, I'll edit in some swear words for you.
So I tried to put this together as a presentation for tried to put on my creative writing hat and tried to focus on what big concerns I would have as an author and what sort of folk remedies and kind of stories that float around and get into the ether should be dispelled. And so I put together some stuff that's really like a lot of copyrights and First Amendment issues and a few business things. So why don't we start with copyright? Copyright is an intellectual property, like trademark and patent. And when we're thinking of property rights, it's really good to think of them as like a bundle of sticks. If real estate, commercial property, any type of property that you have, think of it as a bundle of sticks. You have certain rights to do things. You have rights to dispose of property. You have rights to let others on your land, right? So for intellectual property, an author who writes a book has the, as soon as that book is written down, they have the copyright in it. And they have the right to make copies of that book, the right to be credited for the creation of that book, and the right to determine who can borrow or adapt from the work to other forms, like, screen rights to a short story or a novel, who could perform the book, give a public reading, or do an audio book. You have that right from the moment you write it down. And then who benefits financially, who gets the money from the proceeds of any sales of that book. And then other related, or they call them moral rights. So, we're gonna do just a little bit of history. We all like to do our research and know where things come from, right? So where does copyright come from? It comes from Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution. And it's, the Congress shall have the power to promote progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So that's a copyright and patent clause. You can see progress of science and useful arts. That's all. It covers inventions and writings. And copyright, so that was in the Constitution. Then Congress went and used that power in 1790 with the first Copyright Act. There's three acts and then some other amendments and to that act. In 1790, that act gave the sole right and liberty of printing, reprinting, publishing, and vending their maps, charts, and books for 14 years. It was to promote education and to get information out there. Free flow of information really is the basic idea. And that's what we're still struggling with today with our new media, because everything's instantly available to everybody. The 1909 Act doubled the length of maps, charts, and books. 14 years and then right to renew for another 14 years if they happen to live that long, back in 1790. 1909, they doubled the length of copyright to 28 years with the right to renew for another 28-year term. Then with the 1976 Act, which is really a lot of our modern and kind of outdated copyright law, it extended it to life plus 50 years for the authors and or 75 years total for corporate authorship, anything that a company makes, all their printed materials. Mark Twain is, I didn't really have the source on it, but I've heard it a few times before. He argued for life plus 50. That was so that kind of came into the realm in 1976. It also did away with the formalities, like having to register the copyright with the copyright office. You don't have to do that. You own the copyright. If I write a poem down right now, if I write a verse down on this piece of paper, I own the copyright instantly. Got all those rights, that bundle of sticks. So then there was the Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998. It's also known as the Sonny Bono Act, because he was the congressman that headed it up. It's also known as the Mickey Mouse Act, because Disney really wanted it too. And that extended the terms to life plus 70 years for authors and 120 years total for corporate authorship. So, for instance, Pixar is going to be able to hold the copyright to Monsters, Inc. until 2121. Came out in 2001, unless the rule changes again, and they can have it longer. So, you know, I mean, let's think about it. You know, there's properties that are 30 years old that are still just getting started. You know, Star Wars is all of a sudden has new life with a whole new trilogy, and it's going to be 40 years old by the time that's done. That's only a third of the way through their copyright, I guess.
What's the average human life expectancy?
Exactly, but, you know, entertainment is forever. These stories are so big. These universes are so big. I don't know. But that's the way it is. 120 years for corporate authorship, but anything that any of us write here, life plus 70 years. So plan your estates accordingly. So we can move on to page 4. And let's talk about how the law applies to self-published and traditionally published works. This is real basic stuff, just real basic, the way the sticks flow between the parties. So again, it's a bundle of sticks. Keep thinking of it as that. Everything you write is automatically copyrighted, so you have that bundle of sticks as soon as you've written it. Self-published authors have those sticks and generally license them or sell them to others. And traditionally, published authors in the past have generally given up some of those in exchange for money. The right to copy, you know, the publisher gets that right. Right to be credited. You know, ghostwriting is something that happens a lot. For example, it's the standard in political biographies. Most of them have a ghostwriter that does it. Or, you know, someone submits a manuscript for a romantic novel and the publisher says, oh, you know, with some editing, this could be the next great Daniel Steele book. How about you sell this to us? And Daniel Steele puts her name on it. Is there a real Daniel Steele? I'm not sure if there is or not. There is.
What was there? Yeah.
So, you know, some authors are brand names, ghostwritten by a team of writers or new young writers with an original idea, and it's co-opted to suit an established author's brand. That's just the fact of it. And also, you know, another one you give up is you can, instead of keeping the screen rights and holding out and dealing with Hollywood, you'd give up the screen rights to the publisher in exchange for a bigger advance. It just depends on where you're at and what you might want.
So that bundle of sticks, it's not a case where you could take some of those sticks out and go, well, you know, a little bit of money for just a couple of these. Do you have to give the whole thing as...
No, individual sticks. You know,
you can.
Sure, absolutely. You can retain
some.
So
the more you give, the more rights you give up, the more money you can ask for. Is that generally how it works?
Generally.
Okay.
You know, real generally. I mean, it's we're all free to exchange whatever we want, no matter what position we're in. If we're self-publishing or if we're working with a big publisher, I mean, it just depends on who has more leverage in the situation. Question?
What about different countries? You know, I know these are more like, you know, the copyright laws of the United States, but you can sell your rights to have your book printed in Germany or UK and all that, right? Those are all individual sticks? Or
they call them foreign language rights? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. I mean, you can... With publishers, if you're signing individual deals, it could be a worldwide deal with McGraw-Hill, or it could be a smaller deal with a smaller publisher that's only the United States. And if you're self-publishing, likely you're going to be doing it on the internet and printing up a few specialty books or something like that. So you're kind of publishing worldwide there. Translation rights, absolutely, to have it translated into different languages and copied worldwide.
I've heard of that, though. Self-published authors who do pretty well suddenly are approached by foreign countries and say, we'll do the conversion for you and put it up and publish and sell, and we'll give you a package deal of X dollars. And then you are basically, now you're becoming traditionally represented in another country. And you sign that agreement, which would have these, what rights you're giving up for how much. You sign that, and then they're able to publish your work in another country under another language. Be careful of, I've heard of this, be careful of signing your rights to another country in the English language, because then they could sell through Amazon back here. Someone has actually, I can't remember who it was, but there was another publisher publishing her work, competing with her own. So they're getting the money, and they paid her the rights to do it, and she signed for it. So be very careful with that. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I just, Conrad and I talked about it earlier, just want to make sure that this is a real casual environment here. If you have a question at any point, just feel free to raise your hand. And yeah.
When you work for a company and they pay you, it's a work for hire.
That's a pretty common model. You know, when you're writing for a magazine, I've got a friend that's doing some stuff for City Pages, and he asked me to look over the agreement with what he does, and it's a standard work for hire agreement where you're writing you're contributing to their product, which is the magazine. You know, you're to that weekly paper, and generally you give up all your rights, the copyrights. So you're transferring your rights to them, and they have it, but you have the right to keep it for in your portfolio, and you can say, I'm associated with this magazine.
Enter it in contests.
Yeah, enter it in contests. They have the right to, you know, alter it and edit it to suit their needs, of course. That's the nutshell. So that's work for hire, and where essentially you're doing some work as a contribution to a greater thing. Another thing for self-published authors or illustrators, you know, a lot of times they'll get some cover art for their ebook or for the book. Generally, that's a work-for-hire relationship between the publisher and the illustrator. You know, you're creating this illustration based on this written work that I've done, a character, perhaps. And so I'm paying you X amount of dollars to give me this illustration to contribute to the work as a whole, the final product of the book, the published book. So that's another example of work-for-hire. And all rights are assigned to it. generally, one good way to do it is for the... It depends on the relationship. You can bargain for these rights all you want. But generally, the best thing to do would be, one way to go, really, would be for that artist to sign all the copyrights to the publisher. So we can freely publish it, do promotional materials, alter the cover art to suit the book cover's needs with print on it, you know. So that's a derivative work of the original work is what they call it. Any other questions on that? Nope. All right. So why don't we move on to registration? This is a mechanical part of the whole thing that you should all know the basics of. And there's some misinformation that kind of floats around on the web because no one knows exactly what's going on. So we can clear this up very quickly. Registration. Like I said again, and I love to make this point, you already have copyright in anything you've written. So you don't have to register or place notice of copyright, like the copyright symbol, the circle C symbol. You don't have to do that in order to have copyright in your written work. But if notice is included, there's no innocent infringement defense. If a loose copy of your manuscript, you know, got lost and winds up on the bike trail at Lake Calhoun and someone picks it up and it has no name or copyright information on it, there might be an innocent infringement defense, even though you found it and you're appropriating it. Someone would use it as their own. I don't know why.
Just to add a comment, do not put your copyright on your manuscript when you submit it to editors. One, they know enough about the industry that they could not have an innocence defense anyways. And two, putting it on there makes you seem like an amateur and can be taken as a personal insult.
It's basically you're accusing them of wanting to steal your stuff.
I didn't type this on here. You would totally steal my book.
So this is why at the bottom of a lot of websites you'll see copyright of, and that's mm-hmm. the reason. If you didn't have that, there could be a...
Well, notice, you're the publisher of your own website, right? And so that's serving notice to everybody. There's protocol, and there's all sorts of nuances to placing notice. It's presumed that you're an author and that you know that you own the rights to
it. But that's C. We can put that on anything that we make. That's our own. That's, you don't have to do anything special to have to put that little C in the circle on your work.
No.
Okay.
Is there a real need to put anything like all rights reserved along with the copyright? I see that a lot on websites.
It's a option. You know, you can describe what rights you have. Sometimes it's helpful. You can say all rights reserved, or if you're doing something in the Creative Commons, you can say some rights reserved, and you can describe what those are. I'll get into that a little bit later. We're going to touch on the Creative Commons a little bit. I'll show you what the options are on that. That's a good point. So if notice is included, there's no innocent infringement defense. And if it's registered with the Copyright Office, and this is important, that's how you can pursue damages for any infringement occurring after registration. So you can't pursue damages unless it's registered with the Copyright Office.
So you can register with the Copyright Office, but you don't have to put the notice on the article.
That's correct. So if you're going to do a screenplay and it's not considered good form to put that copyright notice on there, you can register it with the Copyright Office and then send it off to people who, without notice, to people who don't want to see that notice.
You can't pursue damages, though, without registration, but you can still file a takedown notice.
That's correct, yeah. That's the type of remedy that you could pursue without filing it. You can with the Copyright Office. So you go through the copyright process with it's less than $50 to register any work. You know, it's not a big deal, and you can do it online. You can send in an e-copy of the work. So once that's registered, you can pursue any damage occurring after the registration date. If there was previous damage, so you see an infringement of your work, you're making copies, and I didn't allow you to, and they're like, whatever. So you can go and get a takedown notice, and if they're selling it and they're making money off of it, you're not going to be able to recover those damages in court until after you register.
Can you register after?
You can register after. Okay, and you can, and once it's registered, you'd have to calculate the damages after that date of registration. So you see that it's a timeline. The infringement's going from here to here. And then you register here, you can get damages going down this way.
Even if it's intellectual property?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now if you're a self-publisher then, would you want to register if you're... Because I assume the publishers are going to register it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it's always a good idea to... anything that you want to keep protected, anything that you think you might want to get full protection on, that's your choice. I mean, you anything published or unpublished, you can register or not register. You just need to be aware of what you're able to do with infringement after it. You know, with registering or not registering, is what I'm saying.
If you've registered it and you revised it, is your own revision considered a derivative work of your own work, or do you have to re-register
revision? Oh, that's a good question. So what that would be is... I'm not going to be 100% sure on this answer. I don't think it's a derivative work per se. I think what it is it's a new updated work. That new edition is it derivative or not?
Well, textbooks, I just can't remember. On the copyright page, you'd see several
right.
years or whatever listed.
But it is derivative. Wouldn't it still be protected by the same copyright since it's still derived from the same source? Does it go down to derivatives of derivative?
Well, say you change... How much do you change? You got a new chapter. You have an addendum to it. You have an afterword or something like that you're going to publish if it's a biography or something. Okay? That new piece would be of the same piece, or it, I forget how that works. It's all still part of the same work. It's just a fresh take, and that's a new copyright. That edition
has its own copyright for the subject.
Sure.
Yeah. Or if you wrote a screenplay of a novel, you would want to register them both separately if they were both yours. You know what I mean? If you wrote a screenplay of your own novel.
Yeah, a screenplay is a real good example of a derivative work, and that's a brand new, fresh work in and of itself. That's a new expression of your idea, and so that would be a separate copyright.
Mm-hmm. So, an audiobook based off of original, even the intellectual property is the same. The words are the same, but it's a different medium.
Oh yeah, an audiobook is a performance of your book, and you'd have rights to. You already have rights to the book. And then you also have rights to the recorded performance, because a recording is a copyrightable medium too, just like a song. There's the song itself, the words and the music, and then there's
the actual recording of it.
There's the recording
locked down in time.
There's "Hey Mr. Tambourine Man" by Bob Dylan, and then there's the Byrds recording of it. Right? Two different expressions of the same idea.
So I have a question. It's been a big push the last few days about Random House coming up with what they call the Hydra imprint, which as far as I can
see... Because it's a monster.
It's really... They're taking the Vanity House, Vanity Press model. There's another company that does publications called Hydra Publications,
mm-hmm.
which is... People are looking at them and saying nasty things to them.
Could you expand on that a little?
Yeah, I haven't heard that.
Basically, Random House and the Hydra imprint said, we're not going to give you an advance, and you will pay for all the development costs, and then finally when it's published and you do all the publicity, we'll split the profits.
Yeah. And it's worse than that, though, because some of the costs they specify are very open-ended,
yeah.
and they are to cover things that publishing houses usually consider
right.
part of their normal operating setup costs.
Mm-hmm. And they want a complete, and you transfer your whole copyright.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you transfer your whole copyright, all future rights, international rights, like all the rights gone.
What, so what are they giving? What are they giving the author in return?
Publication.
You can be a published author.
Publication.
You can do the same thing with a Vanity Press.
They're also taking print rights, too.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
All right. They're taking print rights, but are they promising to print it?
No.
No.
If they choose to. It's an
wow.
If they choose to.
Why is that
situation.
Funny?
It's all. Oh.
Wow. So you guys are.
It's ugly,
well,
ugly, ugly.
Promise to print would be based off of the contract specifics that you sign.
Mm-hmm.
Most contracts, nobody in an initial contract is promising to print you right away either.
John Scalzi. They did a very, very good analysis.
His blog is called whatever.
Okay.
and it's fun to read, too. If you enjoy...
yeah, I'll have to check that out.
It's a fun post.
He's... I subscribe to his post, and one day I got four blogs. I keep doing that.
Right.
But he's an excitable guy.
Well, I want
to. Publishers have been going after rights grabs for 5 to 10 years. They've been increasing what they're asking for up
right.
front.
Well, they're seeing things like Pottermore, where they didn't get the rights that they should have, or they lost money just because they didn't have that clause in. And now I'm drawing a blank on the name. Who's the guy who did the Harry Potter?
J.K.
Rowling. Kept all the electronic rights. She made this Pottermore site and releasing new work through that. The publisher gets none of the money. So, they're seeing that and they're just expanding their scope on contracts.
Well, I want to congratulate all you authors because you finally are getting screwed as bad as musicians have always gotten screwed.
I was saying, seriously, the Hydra contract looks like, I call it a Chuck Berry contract.
Yeah.
Just signed everything away.
Yeah, that's how musicians got it for years. You know, it's like always. And there was about it. You know, there's about who said it? I think it was Mick Jagger said it just a couple years ago that there was about a 27-year period where artists could actually make money off of records. Happened to be during their entire heyday from about 1968 to 1995 or 6 or something like that. You know, and that's as long as it was, you know. And our record contract was at the very, very, very end, perhaps one of the very last contracts where we actually got money for making records that they didn't know how to sell. But that's another story. But that's really kind of what it's coming to. That's kind of the shape of the position of that authors have versus publishers right now. And Hydra is probably not the publishers are probably looking at that type of situation with envy, you know.
There are two Hydras. One is called Hydra Publications,
mm-hmm.
and it's a small press,
mm-hmm.
which does not screw their writers,
mm-hmm.
and then there's Random House, which has screwed their writers. I mean, you have major writers forming their own organizations, put out their own books. I can't remember her name. Damon Knight's wife. It was a well-known science fiction writer, and his wife, Kate Wilhelm, has established her own press to put stuff out because she absolutely refused to deal with the mainline publishers. And that's happening more and more. There are other people that are doing the same, other publishers, people in the science fiction community, which are doing their own publishing by forming formal publishing houses to compete with the majors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using Facebook and other social media to let people know what's going on. I think that
so is it more like an artist collective then? Or?
No, they have a company, and then Kay Wilhelm's company was basically to go back to all the back issues of her and Damon Knight and publish them. And then after that, they will publish other people. But going to the backlist, so the backlist becomes available.
A lot of these people who have back catalogs are doing that, mainly because of the e-publishing stuff.
Yeah.
If they can do it, print on demand, if they can get the rights back.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
CJ Cherry, I think, is approaching it that way, too. And she's a fairly major science fiction author. She spells her name C.J. Cherry, ends with an H.
Okay.
So she is different than the word Cherry.
Right. Right.
Who else? Maureen McHugh, I think, may be also doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are really quite a few people that are doing that, because even for mainline, big-time publishers, there are very few that make money. The only one I can think of that I read about is Mike Resnick. And he has this whole separate industry going.
Wow, what is he?
Yeah. He's an industry all by himself.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So back to copyright. So when we register the copyright, that's when we change the C to a R. Is that right? The little R with the circle in it. That's what that would mean, that it has been registered.
You can do that if you wish. I mean, you can just say, if you're going to publish anything, just say copyright, you know, and you can put the year and who owns it and the number, you know, who, what rights are reserved. I mean, it depends on. It's always good to put notice, you know, of some sort. But you could just generally, it's just C and the year. Best practice really is just to register everything you intend to solicit to agents or publishers beforehand, or to publish. Not placing notice, that's different. You know, not placing notice on the product. But I'm talking about the practice of registering with the Copyright Office. So, I mean, it's always your choice.
I have a question.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
There's something very similar about people who are inventors, and what they do is they have, there's a bound notebook, and every page is numbered sequentially, and they use that to establish priority of invention.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you work for, like, 3M or something like that, they have the people who do their research take their notes in bound notebooks, and they're dated so that they can establish priority of invention. And PM has been in some copy, trademark and patent cases recently that have either cost them hundreds of millions of dollars,
right,
or they've paid hundreds of, or they've collected hundreds of millions of dollars. So for them, it's really important. Now, I don't know if they register all their notebooks, but their priority, they have a protocol to create priority.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they need to register those, though, because if you are working for someone and it's part of your employer contract, that what you build on on your company time with company resources is company property, right?
This is not personal protection. It's how the corporation protects their rights.
Yeah, right. Did you have a question?
I don't know if you covered this part of it, but I'm going to ask. When it comes to copywriting, you're writing fiction. You can copyright. Somebody told me that you can't copyright an idea.
Correct.
So my question is, what can you copyright? Is it plot, characters, or you can't copyright the idea, or you can, or is that, do you
that's
see
a
that
good. Let me reiterate that for the people listening, the podcasters, you can't. Can you copyright an idea, or at what level does it become copyrightable, I think is how you're asking. Where do we, character sketches or plot outlines down to the actual finished work, where do, what point can we copyright something if you can't copyright ideas?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not the idea that's copyrighted, it's your expression of the idea that's copyrighted. It's the originality of your expression. So it's your story. It's your characters and story.
So once it's done.
Even before.
So it would be like your characters, your plot, and
it would be
what's have to be words on the page.
It's the words on the page. It's yeah. It's the sequence of words it's any original expression that's permanently fixed in some medium. So, let's do it right now. I got a piece of paper here, and I'm going to write, plums are purple.
Wait a minute, I had this idea already.
Before they fall. There's my poem. I've got the copyright in the idea, in the expression of that idea of a plum turning purple and falling. I just expressed it. I got the copyright on that. Jack.
So could I say, write down, purple plums fall, and that would be okay because of my expression of the same idea or something like that?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
All right.
The shortest copyrighted story out there is 6 words. So.
Yeah, I mean, anything you write down on a napkin, anything you scratch down, you get the copyright in that. I mean,
unless
you,
it's a recipe.
Yes.
Yeah, recipes aren't copyrightable. No. They're not sufficiently original. They're instructions to do something.
There's the thing to get around is that when there's a very limited way of numbers to express a thing, you cannot copyright an expression of it.
Mm-hmm. Apparently they fall under trade secret law, though, because Coca-Cola has sued people into oblivion for trying to find out their recipe.
Mm.
That's interesting.
Well, that's a trade secret.
Yeah.
And that's a different type of intellectual property that's protectable.
But characters are part of a copyright. I can't write Han Solo.
Right.
No matter what he's doing. He's bagging groceries downstairs here. Mm-hmm.
Well, under the realm of fan fiction, which we'll get to in a bit.
Yeah, I can't make money from it.
Oh, right. Okay. Lucas is pretty cool with you doing your fan fiction, though. You know, that's kind of how it goes. We're going to get to fan fiction a little bit.
Lucas is now owned by Disney.
Right.
They might not be so cool.
Yeah, right. We'll get to that. Notorious for not being friendly towards.
I wonder how
potential infringement.
Well, I wonder how they're going to treat it. It's sort of, you know, it's up to the author. We'll get to fan fiction in a little bit, and that'll be an interesting topic. I want to. There's one more item on here that I really just have to talk about. It came up.
I hear about this one a lot in writers' groups.
Okay,
about this all the time.
Yeah, this the poor man's copyright, the practice of putting your work in an envelope and mailing it to yourself. Just want to say once and for all, you're wasting a stamp in an envelope. It has no legal effect, and for several reasons. If you want to register your copyright to protect it, you register it with the Copyright Office. That's the procedure. And also, it's very easy to... it wouldn't come in as evidence anyway in court because it's pretty easy to manipulate the date on any postage machine and get the date that you want out of it. So any way that you slice it, no, it's not a notion that's taken seriously in law, and just get it out of your head. If you want to copyright something and protect it, you register it with the Copyright Office, and it's less than $50 to do it. So, excuse me, my voice has been a little, I've got that, I've had a cold since, I think, January 1st. So, I want to talk about the Creative Commons, and this is where you were talking about how many rights you're reserving. This is great for modern web-based media like blogs. If you have a blog, this is a great way to do it. You can put some of your sticks into the public domain and retain others. For instance, you can allow for modification of your work, or you can allow for commercial use of your work at no charge to you. You can give it away for free and say, go ahead, make money with this idea, but I retain credit for the idea. All while retaining authorship credit right for your work. One idea that I'm playing with in my whole Space Skull universe, there's a couple of characters we've come up with where we just can't use them, but it would be fun to maybe just put them up as characters. Here's a character. Do a character sketch for, you know, somebody else to use. What if that character works in somebody else's story? What if it's a good match? You got it up on your blog, here's my character sketch. They can alter it or not at all and just use it, and you get credit along with them. It's a great way to spread your creative influence. That's the way the internet works, you know?
It works really well in music, to give away some free samples as a Creative Commons, say, share it online, please, but make sure you credit us so that people who hear it know where to go to get more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Creative Commons. I've done some of that with music.
It's a unique...
We have a question.
Is there a process for putting it in Creative Commons, or you just announce that it's in Creative Commons and that's sufficient?
You announce it. Go to creativecommons.org, and they have a tool, and it's just a series of questions. What do you want to go into the Creative Commons? Do you want it to be... Do you want to allow for modification of your work? Or do you want to allow for commercial use of your work, unaltered or altered? But you retain the authorship credit. And it's very easy, and it puts together the license for you. Like, it just says exactly what it is, and it puts it together, and you've got it all ready to place notice on your work. It's a good tool.
Different installments, like copyleft.
Some people call the Creative Commons a copyleft because it's not a true copyright.
Well,
it's like a variation.
It is a copyright. It's just a different type of.
I'm sorry, it's not a registered copyright.
It's not. No. But you're retaining some rights and you're giving some away.
It's gone up in court and stood, mm-hmm. I believe, so it is legal.
Yeah, question.
Copyleft is actually, it is actually a technical term, and it doesn't apply as much to writing. At least I haven't seen it used to apply to writing because Creative Commons covers this. But copylefting is the process of using a license, an actual registered license, like the general public license, which says that you can modify a work, change it. You can't sell it. I believe you don't need to attribute it, but the important thing is that anything created as modification of something under the GPL also has to be released under the GPL.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that this was actually intended for software developers.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that they would be able to release works for free while making a very strong statement, registering it, saying that no one else could come along and essentially steal the copyright from them.
Right.
So obviously I shouldn't be giving legal advice. So I wasn't aware copyleft was an actual technical term. I thought it was a derogatory slang against the the Creative Commons.
Mm-hmm. So you can go to places like creativecommons.org, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great resource for all this Creative Commons type of stuff and what you want to put into the public domain, what you might choose to put in there just for free if you want. For posterity, to help promote yourself as a writer, anything like that. Oh, there was two of them, creativecommons.org and then the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. They're actually a legal organization that works on behalf of new media and works extensively with, they've been friends of the court in a lot of different cases. They've written opinions. They've written amicus briefs and submitted them to the Supreme Court for. There was just a case that happened in 2011, I think, last year? It was decided in 2012, where copyright actually extended backwards to bring us more in line with the rest of the planet, with something called the Berne Convention. And so there was it was found constitutional to make a lot of foreign works that had fallen into the public domain here in the U.S. protected again. All sorts of stuff. A lot of stuff written before 1928, I think it was. I'm not sure. I forget the date. I wrote a huge paper on it, and I can't remember a detail about it anymore because it was the outcome of the case was so heartbreaking. But... anyway, let's get back to this. At the bottom of the... Oh, go ahead.
Europe has a different copyright length mm-hmm. than the United States. So a lot of, say, the music or the jazz, from the jazz era in the 1940s, in Europe, is public domain now, but in the United States, it's still copyright.
Is that true? Because what's happening, it may have been registered here in the United States.
Well, it was American jazz.
American jazz.
It was copyrighted in the United States and then copyrighted in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But in Europe, the copyright lapsed.
Okay. That can be for a number of different reasons, too. It's very strange. Part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the early 90s was extending copyright privileges to Europe, to European works that had fallen into the public domain. And what that was doing was bringing us more in line with some of their laws in the hopes of more global trade. And so, but there's holes everywhere just due to also things like, you know, the Soviet Union having not being a trade partner for so long. And then, you know, previous to the formation of the EU, there were different copyright laws in each country. So there's a lot of gaps there. And there could also be lapses in formalities or failure to extend the copyright. It's a very complex case by case type of situation with all of that.
I'm going to assume that you
run into a lot of issues where the vagaries of it meant that it applies to a lot of emergent technologies that didn't exist at the time, which is why there's that big debate at the moment about unlocking cell phones being legal or not.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, wasn't something that was even an issue when the DMCA came out, that just happens to fall under it.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of law has to catch up with technology. That's the biggest problem. Okay, let's move on to the fair use doctrine. This is something that I think authors can debate until the cows come home, because it's really a case-by-case thing, and it's really interesting. All right. Fair use is a defense to infringement. And so if a use of a copyrighted work is within the fair use doctrine, it's not infringement. It generally applies to things like news reporting, criticism, teaching, scholarship, and research, but it's not limited to those things. And there's a four-part test in court. When it gets to court, this is how they decide whether or not a use of a copyrighted work is fair use. So the first test is purpose and character of the use. Is it commercial or educational, or is it transformative or reproductive? So it's like, is there money involved, or is it for a non-monetary purpose? Is it sufficiently transformative? Does it change it into something so unique that it's its own expression of an idea?
Can you
say that one more time? Sure. Is it sufficiently, when they're wondering if it's transformative, they're saying, does the use of that copyrighted work transform it in a way to be a separate, sufficiently original expression of that idea? For instance, let's take a picture of the Mona Lisa. All right, we've got the original painting. Say, just for the sake of argument, it's a copyrighted work. Then someone takes that.
Andy Warhol
takes that, and he does his own job on it, his own vision of that thing, and puts it on a plate and sells it. Let's stick with that Mona Lisa. All right, so, but it's based off of that work, right? It's based off of that original work, but it's sufficiently transformative because it's a plate, it's not a picture, and it's a different vision of the idea of that face, you know?
With different colors on them.
Or really, yeah.
So the transformative is the valid defense. It's not the reproductive that's the valid defense.
Well, it's the degree to which something might be transformative versus reproductive.
Okay.
Okay?
So you would have to transform it sufficiently to go for it to be okay to use it.
You can stretch it. There was a case involving the Corel Corporation that was sort of a Photoshop competitor, and they wanted to show how great their software was at reproducing things. And their software somehow was able to, they were able to draw an exact reproduction of some famous painting that was copyrighted. But it was so good that it wound up being a reproduction, even though it was painted by an artist with the assistance of a computer.
Corrupted, that would Hay Lamar's portrait.
What? And oh, okay.
Hay Lamar, that was the symbol, and she sued them and won, that they used her image without her permission.
Oh, yeah, that's a different case. That's that was a that's a publicity right. We're going to get to that a little bit too.
Okay.
If they caricatured that art, would that be transforming?
It depends. The question is whether or not a caricature of someone would be sufficiently transformative, and it
caricature of art
or of art, it could be
parody, right?
Perhaps. It depends. That's, you get into a lot of iffy questions, and it's really, it, yeah.
It depends. I have a feeling a lot of it isn't yes or no. I have a feeling is how much is it on a scale? You know, how much have you changed it?
So we're
from the original.
So we're only part. We're on part one of this 4-part test. The purpose and character of the use, is it commercial or educational, transformative, reproductive? And then the second step of the test is the nature of the copyrighted work. Is it fictional or factual? How creative is it? How original is it? The third part of the test is the amount and substantiality of the use in relation to the whole copyrighted work. Think the quantity and quality of the excerpt of the piece as an analog. What's the quality and quantity of the use of that, of the copyrighted work? For example, like a few sentences of a book review or of an excerpt of a book for review purposes may be fair use. But if it is so substantive, if it's the heart and soul of one piece, it could be infringement. And then the fourth part is, what's the effect of the use in the potential market? Or are there dollar damages as a result of that use? Let's learn now about how to apply this with the one case called Harper & Row versus Nation Enterprises. This is a case from 1985, Supreme Court case. It's Gerald Ford's memoir, which he licensed to Harper & Row. Harper & Row contracted for excerpts to be published in Time magazine. And then The Nation magazine scooped Time. This is his memoir that came out in the early 80s, and it talked a lot about his pardoning of Gerald Ford. And he was speaking out for the first, or pardoning of Richard Nixon, speaking for the first time about why he really did it. So The Nation scooped him, and they excerpted around 300 or 400 words, verbatim quotes from the 500-page book, without permission from Ford, Harper & Row, or Time. And as a result, you know, they printed it, and then Time canceled the contract because they were scooped, and Harper & Row lost the money that would come from that contract. So Harper & Row sued The Nation for copyright infringement, and The Nation claimed fair use, saying in part that, you know, Ford is a public figure, his reasons for pardoning Nixon were of a vital national interest, and the appropriation of those excerpts should thus qualify as fair use. More of a journalistic angle. So the Supreme Court didn't buy that public figure and vital national interest argument and just said, we're going to apply the fair use test. And they found that the purpose of the use was commercial. It was a competitive scoop on Time magazine. The nature of the copyrighted work, the biography, was informative. It was to give information. And so they were scooping that information. And here's the interesting part. The amount and substantiality of the less than 400-word excerpt used in relation to the whole book was found to be great, substantial, or material, as lawyers call it. And the courts often call it, because those less than 400 words represented the heart and soul of the work. It's what everybody wanted to read. His thoughts about why he pardoned Nixon. So the effect, and then the commercial effect of The Nation's article on the potential market was also great, because it resulted in a canceled contract between the publisher and Time magazine.
You have greater than 400, less than 400 on that.
Oh, sorry. That's the wrong carrot. So we'll have to flip that. Thank you. I'll correct that for future. So everybody understand how that comes from? That's a really simple distillation of that analysis. But let's compare it with another case a couple years later for unpublished works. And this is a great case, Salinger versus Random House. And this concerns a journalist who found some private letters that Salinger had written in public libraries and wanted to use them for a biography. So Ian Hamilton was the journalist, and he started working on a Salinger biography, and he asked J.D. to collaborate, and he was, of course, refused. Hamilton found letters in libraries and public universities that Salinger had written to people, prominent friends like judges, publishers, and colleagues like Hemingway. Very interesting stuff. So Hamilton signed agreements with the libraries not to publish them without consent, but he decided to quote them extensively anyway, saying he considered including them essential to the craft of biography. Excuse me. And Salinger got a hold of a proof copy of the book and called his lawyers. Hamilton tried to cooperate by paraphrasing instead of quoting the letters directly, but Salinger objected again, and Hamilton said, well, I'm going to publish it anyway. So he sued Hamilton Random House for an injunction against publishing this book. So it went to the Court of Appeals, and they found for Salinger. And they noted that the 1976 Act did a waiver of formalities, and you need to register it and give file and place notice on, you know, any unpublished works like letters. So again, there was a four-part test. And the purpose of the use was one of criticism or scholarship, which is fair use. But the fact that the letters were unpublished was a critical element of them as copyrighted works. The author has control over things like the right to first publication, to control how they're published for the first time. Here, Salinger didn't have control. And the direct copying of the letters was first publication of the letters, even excerpts. The second part was the amount and substantiality of the copying. Paraphrasing didn't reduce the amount or substantiality, the quality or quantity. And this is where it gets too complex for this discussion. And I put a link for a detailed analysis of the paraphrasing and how it compares to the original writing. It's in Wikipedia. So you can go look it up and scrutinize between what J.D. Salinger wrote and what Hamilton tried to do to kind of fudge around. And the potential effect on the market was, you know, by publishing those paraphrased letters, the effect on the market was great because, you know, in case Salinger may have wanted to publish those letters in the future, or his estate might want to, or not at all, because, you know, Salinger's business model is, you know, directly inverse to most authors. You know, we think that most words that we write and publish are worth something, but for Salinger, it seems to be the less he wrote, the more valuable everything he did write became, you know. So it's sort of his brand. So I want to throw some issues out and see if we can discuss a little bit. What do you think? There's a First Amendment free speech issue here, I think, that comes up. The case complicated this author's ability to write a biography that was of interest to people. You know? So the copyright on those letters is life plus 70 years.
Even though it was the person who received it, received the letter, doesn't have, and you probably covered
that. We haven't covered that yet. That's a good question. The question is, even though Salinger wrote those letters and sent them to somebody else, well, they owned the manuscript. You know, they were given the manuscript. It was a letter, a physical letter, but the copyright is still owned by the author, and the copyright to that letter, that personal letter, is still owned by the author. So when should those letters be available? When can someone write that autobiography with those letters? Here's the issue. Is the public's right to know what's in Salinger's letters greater than Salinger's right to decide where, when, and if to publish it? Is the author being censored by not being able to use those publicly available letters that are available in libraries for anybody to go and check out and to have a look at? Or, what about Salinger's right to privacy? The right to free speech also includes a right to silence. What do you think?
It's interesting because nowadays on Wikipedia you can go look up a lot of people's biographies that they had nothing to do with, nothing to say about.
Sure.
And what if they didn't want it up there? That's very interesting. What is publicly, what should or can be publicly available versus what you want to be publicly available? I don't want people posting, you know, my address online.
Right.
You know.
Sorry. I'll fix that afterwards.
It was true.
What's that?
What she wrote was true.
Yep, we gotta take that down. So yeah, it's interesting the ability now to, especially with the web, to be able to post things and things you may or may not want up there. The public may have a right to know where I live, but I don't necessarily want people to know. Yeah.
Is there anything that qualifies right to know in terms of the public's right to know, like they'll be at risk or they can't make some other decision? This would affect decisions that they would make as opposed to just their innate curiosity, or is public's right to know an open door to whatever you want to say because somebody might want to know?
Well, it's more of the, I mean, this, for purposes of authorship, say biography, I mean, it's more of a free speech, First Amendment. I should be able to write what I saw in these letters that I read at the library, shouldn't I? Right?
That's the core issue is the taking of those particulars that were in that letter.
Mm-hmm.
And putting them in here. He had just paraphrased what it
was. Versus the actual form of the words that were in the letter.
Right. I think there are several issues. One, J.D. Salinger was notorious for not wanting any publicity about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And his biographer knew that. So you respect that privacy. The second issue is when you send a letter to somebody, when you have the copyright and it goes into a public setting, doesn't in effect become published when it is in a public setting.
Letters to the editor or something like that?
Well, letters to the editor, but letter to your friends who then take their collection and say, here is for everybody. At that point, does it become in effect published, but not necessarily by the author, but by the friend?
Mm-hmm. I heard that Jane Austen had all of her, after she died, was either a sister or a relative, had all her letters returned to her. She wanted that to happen, and they were burned.
It was her sister.
Well, it was a sister.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there's an expectation when you send somebody a letter that you sent them the letter to read, but as a writer, you still own that copyright.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I don't really see that there's a, you know, that letter, you didn't give the person who got the letter the right to do anything with it other than read it.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than you'd give a publisher the right to read your manuscript when you give it to them. Mm-hmm.
Right. If you got a letter, you own it. Granted, you don't own the copyright.
No, but you don't have a right to sell the rights to somebody else to publish it.
But you can talk about it.
You could publish the facsimile because you own what's being published, but you own it.
I don't think you could.
Well, these letters, the original letters, wound up in the library. And they're available for public view, and they were guarded so no one would make facsimiles of it.
But you can go down and look at them.
And yeah, making a facsimile of it is making a copy. The rights to that copy, to make that copy, are owned by the author, and they have it then, even though they've been given the original handwritten letter, perhaps, or typewritten letter. Yeah. But the author, whatever letter you write to your aunt or your niece or your brother-in-law, I mean, it's, they have that piece of paper, but the author has automatically, upon writing it, the right to make copies. And it isn't transferred by giving that letter.
It really makes me wonder whether Salinger should have been able to deny these people that he sent the letters to the right to hand them over to a public library. I mean, it kind of almost feels like that was a copyright infringement in a way itself, because
right.
They're private letters.
That's the transition from private to public, right?
It's a physical property versus intellectual property difference.
Right, that's the distinction. That's a piece of physical property. The for all intents and purposes, that physical letter was the property of Hemingway or the judge by the name of Learned Hand was his name. and he was friends with Salinger. I think they kind of lived nearby each other. And he wrote a letter to him. They were pals. One of those letters just was passed through, you know, was just happened to get into the hands of the library through, you know, people that wanted to donate it for public use. And so, you know, you can take a look at it. You sign out. You're allowed to view the letter. And then they take it back into the room and put it in its cryogenic tube.
I can give you a book I own, but I can't make copies of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that.
But you could have paraphrased, or not necessarily paraphrased, but said, well, J.D. said too, somebody saw on such and such a date, he in effect said this. If he's far enough away from the letter, he's doing it as a news event. He's reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, is that a violating copyright? If he's reporting it as a news event?
Again, I think that gets into the paraphrasing, that amount of substantiality. And it's not, I don't think it's a yes-no thing. I think it's a, how, on a scale, how much did he take?
It's a case-by-case basis. And if, yeah, to look, to answer your question, you should go to that link on that I put there. It's a Wikipedia. It's got the, you can go down to a detailed analysis of the paraphrasing to see what actually was written. It's quite interesting. And all that four-part test, they all work together. They're all proportional to each other. They all have an effect on each other, and it's a very complex thing. Pages and pages and pages in those final court analyses of those. But yeah, I mean, it's that's a tricky issue. Who, you know, does it does all of that infringe on somebody's right to write a biography? Maybe you have to write it the right way. But, you know, is that censoring your speech? I don't know. That's why the legal system exists, so people can fight that out on a case-by-case basis, and you just never know the outcome. So let's move along. Let's move along to fair use fan fiction. So, as we were talking about before, George Lucas is an author that's cool with it. Josh Whedon is pretty cool with it. Rowling has been cool with it. She objects to certain uses. She said she didn't really appreciate pornographic parodies of her work. Neil Gaiman is very cool with it. And Cory Doctorow is an author, again, who really speaks out about, you know, fan fiction adaptations of his work, things like that. Anne Rice is not so cool with it, and J.D. Salinger, of course, is not cool with it. It, you know, it didn't really hurt George Lucas. I mean, he said that, you know, around the times those first prequels came out, that people could do write fan fiction and stuff, and the internet just exploded. You know, and it helped invent the internet, I think. People like Anne Rice, they just feel like it dilutes the characters and the universe that they operate in, you know. I don't know. That, to me, is kind of funny coming from someone who did, I think, kind of a fan fiction version of Dracula, but anyway. Yeah?
Sorry, do they have grounds for damages then under the idea that people won't be buying their work because they could read the fan fiction instead for free? I mean, because my understanding is you're not selling it as a fan fiction.
Right. That's right. You know, I think it produced a lot of fans. It really kind of expands their fan base, and it gets people emotionally invested in those characters. You know, because people, science fiction fans tend to be really creative people, and they just love to come up with those different situations and scenarios for those characters.
No, I don't doubt that. I'm just saying, does Anne Rice actually have legal recourse to stop fan fiction?
Sure, all these people do.
Okay.
They all do.
Yeah.
You bet. You bet. They can allow it. They can just say, yeah, I'm going to let this happen. Or they can say, no, I'm not going to.
So it's the case they would have to actually take, or their publisher would have to take someone to court to run through those rules.
Yeah.
And then they'd hit that wall of, you know,
well, let me,
substantiability.
Let me tell you what J.D. Salinger did about it. There was a Catcher in the Rye sequel that somebody wrote. That got stomped pretty hard. They tried to argue that It was sufficiently transformative from the original book, and it was a work all of its own. So, like, you know, a 60-year-old Holden Caulfield is not the same as, you know, the young Holden Caulfield. The case, I think, is still in court, but there's a lot of opinion that just says they've read the work and it's not sufficiently transformative at all. It just seems to be a sequel. That's all the detail. You can kind of look that up if you want, Catcher in the Rye sequel. There's a few interesting things to read about it. There's one other interesting case concerning Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell's work, and there's a woman that wrote a book called The Wind Done Gone by Alice Randall. You guys heard about this?
No.
So it's told from the point of view of a slave on Scarlett O'Hara's plantation. So Margaret Mitchell's estate sued, and the Court of Appeals struck down an injunction against the publication of it. A lot of literary opinions found it to be a radically different story around the basic circumstances and some of the characters that are kind of tertiary, but, you know, it's like, it's told from the slave's point of view on that plantation. Maybe they see Rhett Butler. Maybe they see everything burning. You know, I mean, they deal with those situations, which are all historical references from the Civil War. A lot of people thought it was great. So that case actually settled. And what they did is the publisher made a donation to Morehouse College, and the book carries a sticker on it labeling it unauthorized parody. I don't know if it's a parody, but it's a, you know, I mean, likely if it went all the way to court, they'd probably find it sufficiently transformative. There's no legal opinion on that, but, you know, everybody says it's kind of a great work. It's worth kind of looking into. You know, on the other hand, you all heard of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, Jane Austen wouldn't have a copyright or her estate because that was written in 1813, but he still credits her as an author because he just wanted to. You know, the author just wanted to, and it's even funner, more fun that way. So that's just sort of my quick notions on fair use and two good examples that I could come up with for fan fiction. We can move on to defamation. And that's, this is a danger, or this is something that Conrad brought up to me. It's just like, can I get in trouble for anything I write about other people, or if there's something that happens? This, you know, things like that are, you know, more in the realm of journalism, I think, but they're worth going over. It's a tort, as in the word torture. It's a harm done to someone others. It's a civil term. A tort concerning things people say about other people. There's three elements. It needs to be a statement that negatively affects the subject's reputation, that is published and causes damages. And if the publishing is printed or otherwise in fixed form, that's called libel, and damages are presumed. But if it's spoken, that's a way of publishing it. If I just say it to another person, that's slander. So defenses to that are consent, truth, and privilege. That's like the media engaging in broadcasts or reports of public figures. It's a fair reporting privilege. And it includes non-public speakers speaking about public concern in public. And there's an absolute privilege for accurate reporting, and the privilege is lost for inaccurate reporting. So this all concerns something that's damaging to someone, but if it's in a manner in a public venue. False light, invasion of privacy, this is quite interesting. It's another tort, widespread dissemination of a major offensive falsehood. It doesn't need to be defamatory, it can just be offensive to some. So a very generic example would be misrepresenting somebody's religion, saying they're, let's put it in really light terms. It's saying someone is a worship Satan. All right, they're a Satanist. It wouldn't be defamatory because it wouldn't necessarily ruin your reputation, but it could be construed as offensive. And so, and it's false. It's just not true. A better example would be a photographic one. A photograph could, you know, appear to show something defamatory, but it's out of context. For example, a New Year's Eve photo of two people apparently about to kiss, taken on an iPhone. But in reality, they're simply turning to each other and smiling. All right? So both parties and the photographer knew this to be the case. But the photographer, say, sent it to one party's spouse and said, you know, just to mess with them as a joke, saying, oh, look at you and your spouse, you know, your friend and your spouse. Yeah, ha-ha, great. You know, it's offensive. It's annoying. It's a false light. It's showing something out of context.
Would this extend to taking words out of context, taking a quote, a small quote that is misrepresentative of what they actually said?
That's a good analog, yeah.
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 And both of these definitions of false light apply in fiction as well within journalism?
No, fiction is, you know, fiction is, fiction is fiction.
Okay. Fiction. You were referencing some...
So if I have a character named Bruce Springsteen who's a jerk.
Right. Or you have a character who doesn't like Bruce Springsteen because
right.
mm-hmm. make up some reason. Does he have an issue there?
You know, one of the characters in my comic strip is Jimmy Page. And most of the strip is just a skull flying through space. He's flying through outer space. He's on an errand. And he's flying a check and a lease renewal from Jimmy Page on Earth out to which moon is it? Now I forget. Europa. He's flying out to Europa because that's where Aleister Crowley lives. Now he's been reincarnated as a snowman on Europa. And Jimmy Page apparently rents that mansion that he lived in for so long. He still lives there. So Space Skull gets on the phone with Jimmy, too, because he doesn't want to go into Europa. And there's a lot of talk between Space Skull and Jimmy Page. So Jimmy is a real person, but he's a fictional character. So far, Jimmy's lawyers haven't called me up. So that's my example. You know, but it's something, I don't know, if they had a real problem with it. I mean, I haven't said anything out of line. I've ribbed him a little bit, you know, but it's certainly, I don't know. Jimmy could put his foot down and say, I don't want to be a character in here.
And what would the procedure be? They wouldn't take you to court, but they'd ask you to take it down. Well, because your work is Creative Commons, right?
I don't know what they would do.
But you might get to meet Jimmy Page in person, so it might all be worth it.
I would not be worthy. I know that. So that's my answer. Is, you know, fiction. A lot of fiction contains real characters. Parody, I think, is one way that can be defended. It's sort of parodying a famous person. You know, just kind of no different than a sketch on SNL. Really, you know, that's kind of what my ideas would be on that. So. Let's whip through publicity and personality rights. It kind of ties into this, too. That's the right of a person to control the commercial use of her name, image, license, or other unequivocal aspect of her identity, i.e., you know, anything that's unmistakably you. And that's a state-based right. So it's a little different in each state. California has the Celebrity Rights Act of 1985, and that made personality rights survive the death of the person and pass to the deceased estates, resulting in death being a terrific career move for a lot of celebrities. People like Michael Jackson, Jimi Hendrix, Marlon Brando, John Lennon, Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, and even J.D. Salinger again, they're all brands that are tightly controlled and marketed by their estate. And Marilyn Monroe, there was a case involving her. Her image and her likeness and her persona. And the court found that because she died before the Celebrity Act, her personality was therefore in the public domain, and anybody can use it for anything. So California responded to that with legislation extending the right of publicity to 70 years after death, retroactively applying to anyone dying after 1938. And voila, many dead stars' estates came to life. And the entertainment law field rejoiced. There's a lot of business in maintaining people's star persona after their death.
So can I write a play about a Marilyn Monroe zombie and be in trouble as she comes back to life?
I don't know. Everybody wants her to come back to life. don't they? I have no idea. It's hard to say. I think that, again, you know, using it as a fictional character, as a parody, you know, she still shows up. I don't think she still shows up as different characters. She was the subject of a couple movies. I don't know if their estate was involved in that or not. A couple of recent movies, mm-hmm. I think. You know, again, it's there's always parody to be as a defense. It's a broad First Amendment right for you to do something different. Hard to say. One last thing about your rights and rights of expression. You know, how far, how extreme can your fiction go? How extreme can your writing go? And the truth is, there's really not much left in the indecency type of realm. There's no such thing as it anymore. You know, we've gotten to the point where we're all pretty upfront and frank about what our inner thoughts are. And I mean, there's some things. It really only extends to certain states and their tolerance for certain types of pornography. You know, indecency. That's really what it extends to. But I mean, nowadays, I guess you know, something like 50 Shades of Grey would have wound up in the courts, I guess. But now it just becomes a bestseller. But here's a cautionary tale for you, and I think that this is pretty much done. It's not that a ruckus can't be raised with some provocative writing. This case called Rice versus Paladin Enterprises from 1997. The book was called Hitman, A Technical Guide for Independent Contractors by Rex Farrell. It came out in 1983. The problem only arose in the late 90s. The publisher later claimed it was written by a Florida housewife. To me, it reads about as... Yeah, it reads kind of like a Jim Thompson novel, only a little colder. Kind of reminds me of like the Blair Witch Project, where it's not real, but it's pretending to be real. And it's a technical manual on how to kill people. And how to get away with it. How to stab and shoot people and cover it up. So in the 1990s, there was a triple murder in Maryland. And the suspect claimed to use the book, as its title implied, as a technical manual for murder. So the victim's family sued the publisher, claiming they had a share of responsibility in the deaths by publishing the book. And the appeals court found in 1997 the book was not protected by the First Amendment because they were spooked by it. And the publisher somehow admitted, you know, in their defense that it could have been used as a technical manual. But just like a lot of other things, I think there's all sorts of information everywhere on how to stop someone from breathing, right? There's medical books, all sorts of stuff. So there's a lot of things wrong with this case. But the appeals court found in 1997, and that's just the Court of Appeals, found it wasn't protected by the First Amendment. The publisher was liable for those deaths. So the party settled in 1999, largely because the publisher, Paladin, their insurance company, decided it would be cheaper to just settle, pay a bunch of money to these families, and just have it done, than to go all the way and prepare a Supreme Court case. And that's what happened. Well, there's a lot of opinion. There's some opinions on either side, but there's a lot of opinion that said that the publisher would have likely won. And it would have been... You would have established kind of a bright line for that. I've included that really as just to show you that a ruckus can be raised. And I'm sure, even though we think we live in an age where there's a lot of free flow of information, people are sophisticated and know the difference between something real and something that's totally a work of the imagination, it's not always the case. Not always the case, and people can get upset, and they might try and blame me for something you wrote. I haven't heard a lot of that lately. You know, there hasn't been like a lot of obscenity or other charges. Basically, or inciting to violence or immediate danger, things like that. It really sits right on the shouting fire in a crowded theater. It's about the only example they can think of where speech is unprotected. You know, besides certain types of pornography. You know, that's your standard. Don't shut fire in a crowded movie theater. So that's that. We can talk about business and contracts. I think you could. We can just sort of read through this. I mean, it's very simple. One point I want to put together is, if you're making a contract, don't grab stuff from the internet and Frankenstein it together and think that you put together a fine piece of work. I've worked on cases that have been undoing all the trouble that has caused. It's never, ever a good idea. If you have an idea, talk to a lawyer about it and say, I want this to be in this contract. They'll get in the right language for you. That's really, I know a guy that's probably 18 months into lawyer's fees as a result of doing that, thinking he was doing the right thing. It was not the right thing.
So it's almost like this stuff is another language, and lawyers are kind of the translators of that language. So
that's that.
Hopefully this is all useful to everybody. Any last burning questions before we wrap up? Dan, did you bring business cards or anything like that? Or where can people contact you?
You bet. Yeah, you can look me up if you're on this podcast. Just look for Dan Bowen, lawyer, Minnesota, and you'll find me somewhere. But I brought goodies for people. I brought Space Skull postcards and buttons. Go to spaceskull.net. If you want to look at my comic, there's at our comic, me and Bud Berge. The illustrator's great, so I have postcards and buttons for you all here, too. So thanks a lot for having me. Really a real honor to be able to talk to you guys, and I hope to meet some of you personally. And have any questions, talk to me.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group podcast. The MinSpec podcast is produced by Aberstaff and Wiebe, recorded and engineered by myself, Conrad Zero. Whether you're an experienced writer who wants to help others, or an aspiring writer who wants to make your writing better, join us on the web at meetup.com/MNSPEC.